Absolutely intercultural.
Fullständig interkulturell.
Absolut interkulturalisch.
Absolutamente interkulturell.
Absolutely intercultural.
Welcome to show number 80 of Absolutely Intercultural. My name's Anne Fox and I'm based in Denmark. As well as 80 being a nice round number, this show also marks the third anniversary of the podcast. So I thought it might be a good idea to tell the story of culture through some of the many pieces Laurent Borgman and I have done over the last 3 years. So this will be a sort of audio frequently asked questions to the topic of intercultural communication and competence. So let's start. Question one, what is culture? Is the following culture? Is it singing? Remember the Screaming Men of Finland. Well, maybe that hasn't answered the basic question of what is culture. So listen as Laurent explores the idea of culture as the software of the mind with two guests.
Gerd Hofstede is one of the best-known researchers in the field of intercultural communication, and he has brought up this idea of culture as the software of the mind. Culture as the software of the mind. Now, here in the studio, I think we should now discuss this a little bit because Gerd Hofstede brought up the idea, but it wasn't exploited enough for my taste. I brought it up in a seminar a couple of weeks ago, and Carsten was with me there, actually.
Yeah, you actually introduced me to the topic, and I think it is really interesting, and I find it almost frightening how many similarities there are between culture and software.
It was amazing, yes. I started with a question, where do we get the software from? If we accept the fact that culture is the software of the mind, now we know where we get the software from, so how do we get the software into our heads, the culture?
I think it's mostly about the parents and the school. So education is very important for the culture to get it, to learn it.
So it's actually some kind of teaching in a way that.
Yeah, I think so.
I agree. I think we are being programmed kind of in the same way as software is being programmed. And Beryl, I agree that you said parents and school and your friends are very important. But I think nowadays the media is also very important. There's so much influence by the media that we are kind of sometimes really programmed.
Well, some people actually say that the television set has more influence on the on the culture of the children. Yes,
I'm afraid that could be the case. If children are sitting in front of the TV for hours and hours, they are being programmed by the TV.
Good point. And I think the media is also important, but I think also the school has a big influence because the children are there, and I think if the teachers are very good, they can influence them.
Have an influence on the children, yes. Also, well, the question is, do you think it is more like we are being taught, so as if we were buying a software, or are we, well, in a way, the engineers of our own software? Because, I mean, you could say, yes, the children go to school, they try out a piece of behavior in that school culture, and then from the reaction of the teachers, or maybe even the reactions of the other kids, learn?
I think both is true, because I think we actually learn a lot from our parents, from our friends, from school, just by looking at things, how things are done. But of course, you also learn a lot by trying things out, by trial and error.
Mm.
And if you do something that is really not acceptable in your culture, you will get a very clear reaction on that, and then you are very likely to learn out of that you can't do that.
Yep. So that would be trial and error, and here we would actually be the engineer.
Question two. Why do we need to know about intercultural differences? I once had a colleague who was very proud of the fact that he'd gone to work in Morocco without doing any research beforehand, the idea being that the voyage of discovery was all the more pleasurable that way. However, when I spoke with Mark Karstad about his time as a technical assistant at the Dubai Women's College, I could appreciate the value of a little forewarning about the expectations of behavior between males and females there.
When you go to any other college or university, as you're walking through the student union or something like that, you bump into people. You turn around and, excuse me, you know.
Mm.
And there is an awareness of physical space that I was aware of, that I never made contact with a single student during that whole time. And I can feel proud of that, because it would have been uncomfortable for that student and me to have made that contact because it was inappropriate.
Question 3. What are critical incidents? These are the times when you break the unwritten rules. These tend to be the incidents that make the most impression on you. Here are a couple. Firstly, we hear from Fernando, a Spaniard, talking about a strange party he was invited to during his stay in Germany.
For example, olive oil in Spain is very common. And here in Germany, it's not that common. But at the same time, a few weeks ago, a friend invited me to an olive oil tasting party. I mean, I didn't know that existed. And it was so funny that in Spain, we have olive oil every day in our kitchen, on our table, but we don't talk about olive oil. We don't praise it. So it is fascinating how people in different places deal with basically the same thing.
And here is a second example of a critical incident, this time from Turkmenistan, where American Peace Corps workers come to work. Now, here's an intercultural riddle. You go to stay at the home of a family in Turkmenistan, and you notice that you never see the older daughter. She's always in the kitchen cooking or doing housework, and she doesn't eat together with the rest of the family. Why is this? Is it because A, the family do not want their precious firstborn daughter to mix with foreigners? B, the first daughter is always the least favored in Turkmen families? Or C, it is traditional for the eldest daughter to do all the household chores? The next question is, would it be possible for you to get to know the daughter better? Or must you just accept that you won't be able to speak with her? We'll find out the answer from Zore, who's been organizing Peace Corps placements for many years.
Trainee said that her parents do not like that their older daughter will speak and befriend with her. She said that she observed that every time the elder daughter is in the kitchen, she doesn't eat with them, she doesn't sit with them. So she came complaining with this. And I explained to her that it's not because they do not want to be with you, because in our culture, all the house chores the elder daughter does. And I recommend her to just observe who does all the cooking, washing, scrubbing, all these things. And actually, I realized this just after when I invited foreigners to my house, and they said, why your elder daughter is not with us? And after that, I understood that she was very busy in the kitchen, because in our culture, women in my age do not do anything. Only elder daughters or daughter-in-laws do these things.
You can see that things can be very different and that this can take some getting used to. So this brings us to question 4, what is culture shock? This is when so many rules are different that you get a psychological reaction. Listen how Mark Anderson from South Africa describes his reaction on accepting a job in Korea.
I just went to Korea without really doing any research about the country. And yeah, my first day in Korea was really, it felt like I found myself on the moon suddenly. It was a completely alien and foreign environment. I remember the first day walking down to the supermarket to get something to eat. And none of the foods in the supermarket looked vaguely familiar. You know, there's nothing that I really could recognize there. And everything is written in Korean, and nobody speaks English. So you couldn't ask anyone, you know, what is this that I'm buying? Because no one could explain it to you. So the only thing you could do was to buy the thing and take it home and faced it. Some other things, for example, the streets had no names, and that was the first time that I really experienced this thing called culture shock. And then it was a couple of months later that I read that culture shock is actually a phenomenon. It's a psychological phenomenon. Everybody experiences this when they visit a foreign country, or when they find themselves in a foreign environment. Yeah, I just looked it up on the internet, really, and I found out that there are four stages of culture shock. There's the honeymoon phase, where you feel like everything is wonderful and everything is new, and you're all starry-eyed about this new place, the new culture, different-looking people. And that lasts for about a couple of weeks. And then after a while, you start feeling a little bit homesick. You start to resent the fact that things are not quite the same as they are back home, that things are not as easy as they would be back home. For example, you can't just speak English to everybody. That's one thing. And, after a while, you become really almost, you become a little bit aggressive, really, towards this new way of living. That is, you feel almost like it's imposed upon you. And then after about 3 months or so, you start to feel a sense of acceptance. You start accepting, and you realize that there's nothing really you can do about that. That's just, you are in this set of circumstances, nothing you can do about it. You just got to accept it and adapt to it. Yeah, I don't really remember what all the phases are. But I remember the last one, for example, is what is called reverse culture shock. That's when you go back home to your own country and you realize that things have changed so much that you don't really, the person that you were when you left and the person that you are now coming back is not really the same. Your friends treat you a little bit differently, and you just have a totally different perspective, really, on your own country.
Question 5. Can you learn cultural competence? We've discussed several different ways in which you can train intercultural competence. One of the most innovative was surely the Swedish Living Library initiative.
They call it the Living Library. At the public library in Malmö, Sweden's third largest city, a patron can check out a person for a 45-minute chat. The idea is that with informal, one-on-one dialogue, misconceptions or even prejudices about different religions, nationalities, or professions could be reduced or even eliminated. It's about the library facilitating the spirit of mutual understanding that an honest talk can bring. The plan itself is straightforward. Get individuals of clashing cultural perspectives together, talking frankly with those who don't understand them. For the library to check out people willing to meet with those who want to know more about their mysterious lives and motives, who might want to question the sort of person who frustrates their understanding. Why has this unusual program raised a few eyebrows around the world? For one thing, offering live people as temporary items in a library collection really pushes public perception of library services to the very edge. Patrons at Malmö can check out persons such as a Muslim imam, the leader of worship in a mosque, an animal rights activist, a transvestite. It's an interesting plan, certainly iconoclastic. It dovetails with the library's mission to offer new information to all who may seek it. But why take my word for it? Let's call Malmö, Sweden.
Question 6. Are cultural differences apparent in different communication media, such as email and virtual worlds? Does IT flatten the world and make everyone the same, or does it also reveal cultural differences? I discuss this in relation to the virtual world Second Life with Helen Keegan and Sus Nurop.
When you go into Second Life, one of the first things you have to do is to think about what you look like. And that's a sticky area, I think, because the reason I went into Second Life was because I belong to this group, the Webheads group, which is always exploring new possibilities for teaching English and so on. And we had a meeting in Second Life, and after the meeting, one of the participants of the meeting said something to the effect of, how can you take somebody seriously who comes with dinosaur-shaped slippers?
Yes, oh yes, those slippers.
And,
And he was he all green, like I don't know what?
Yes, yes, he was.
Yeah, I know who that is.
No, well, you see, there you go. See, there is something about the way you look. And,
yeah.
And people are applying rules. They're applying rules, and the rules they're applying, they seem to me to be the ones that they know from home. But I just meant that, that people seem to be carrying their expectations from real life into the second life.
I think there are different approaches. I think some people would be, well, simulating part of themselves. Others would perhaps really go into a new role and try to model a new person in their avatar. And then there are some who are very experimental. I think I've had, for example, my pink punk period.
One thing that's interesting is that people, by and large, do tend to keep to the sex that they are in real life.
How do you know?
Well, just from the webheads people.
Yes.
So I know what they are in real life.
Yes.
But there is an example of a man who has set up shop in Second Life from a disease prevention organization in the United States. So he's trying to promote safe behaviors and so on and so on. And he has gone into Second Life as a woman because he feels that as a woman, he's more approachable in Second Life. So that's interesting, but that makes news. And by and large, I think that people do keep to their own sex.
Yeah, I mean, when I chose my avatar name, I deliberately chose something that I thought was androgynous and then proceeded to go into Second Life and adopt a female avatar. You know, it's just like, and then in terms of, so you're talking about, you know, trying out different sort of avatars and things. And at first I did that quite a lot. And then I spent a very intensive few days in Second Life with pretty much the avatar I have now. And I sort of had it was such an immersive experience. I became my avatar and she became me. And now I feel strange. I've tried adopting different avatars and I don't feel like me anymore. You know, it's quite strange on a, you know, in quite an intense level with your own avatar. It can be quite hard to sort of change and feel the same, if you know what I mean.
I have read some interesting accounts where people have changed gender, and especially men. They seem to learn a lot when they become women.
Uh-huh.
They learn a lot about what it feels like to be harassed and so on.
Yes. Oh,
it's,
God,
it's really amazing.
Question 7. Is there a connection between culture and language? Language is intimately connected to culture. For example, Europeans going to China may experience much more of a culture shock because their languages have so little in common. I discussed the issue with Ken Carroll in Shanghai.
And it is a very different experience to go to a country where you cannot recognize anything at all when people are trying to communicate with you.
Exactly. If you are, you know, as an English native speaker, you could pretty much go anywhere in Europe. And there are, of course, cognates, words that are similar. You know, in English and German, you have house and mouse and man and all of these kind of words. And in English and French, there's plenty of cognates. English has borrowed thousands of words from the various European languages. And there are other clues, I think, cultural clues. But certainly plenty of linguistic clues that you could figure out the meanings of words and you could guess from context. None of that really applies in the case of Chinese. There may be one or two words that are similar, but you'd never guess them from context. I'll give you an example. I mean, the word tea, for example, in English is actually is from a Chinese word. It's actually from a dialect called Fujian dialect. That was pronounced de, and that it was the first British travelers to China who landed off the coast of Fujian and saw this drink. They adopted that. There are a couple of other words like typhoon, which in Chinese typhoon. Again, these are not so much cognates as transliterations. And again, I can't imagine that you, hearing those in context, that you'd actually be able to guess what they mean. So I think you're pretty much, 0%. There's really no way you can guess, I guess, from the sounds. Yeah.
Greenlandic is not only a little spoken language, but also difficult to learn for other reasons. Hear why from Jens Nyland, a Dane who worked in Greenland for 3 years.
So it's a very, very special situation. The Greenlandic language is very descriptive. So it's not like Danish and English. Say you can almost always find a word which is the English word for or the Danish word for this and that. It's not the same in Greenlandic. Then you often describe the things you're talking about. For instance, the example of the ptarmigan, the bird ptarmigan. In East Greenland, I was told the ptarmigan, I don't know how to say it in Greenlandic, but I was told that it's called the one you throw stones at. So you can never know what the word would be used. Somebody have to guess. So it's extremely difficult.
Question 8. Are there any topics which tend to arise more often? Looking back over the last 3 years, I can see that we talk a lot about education. Here's one example of the difference in attitude to learning as described by Bob Compton of 2 Million Minutes.
The difference in India and China is the achievement gaps are not believed to be permanent. And they are very much, they believe, to be within their own control. What's interesting in India and China, if you don't understand a subject or if you get a poor grade in a class, it's not because, I'm just not very good at math. It's because I didn't work hard enough. They actually don't set limits for them. They don't believe they are good in certain subjects and not good in other subjects. And so there's this constant striving to improve.
Another topic which crops up rather a lot is the link between culture and music. We started with the Screaming Men of Finland, and this is an extract of Weightless Escape by Musa Diallo, a prime mover behind the global music festival in Greno, Denmark. The aim there is to build bridges between the native and immigrant populations in Denmark through music. That's a taste of what we've been doing over the last 3 years. Thank you to everyone who's taken part. We couldn't have done it without you. If you have any comments, then you can add them to our blog at www.absolutely-intercultural.com. The next show will be coming to you from Laurent Borgman on April 17th. Until then, stay tuned.
Absolutely intercultural.
Fullständig tvärkulturell.
Absolut interkulturell.
Absolutamente intercultural.
Absolutely intercultural.